Welcome to the podcast of Lancaster Brethren in Christ Church, located in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. LBIC is a community being transformed by the love of Jesus, sharing this love with all people. We want this podcast to be an extension of our community and a connection with familiar voices. Together, we want to think about how to follow Jesus in our particular moment. So enjoy the podcast. We're grateful to have you join us as a part of the LBIC family.
So, I'm really glad for this new pulpit that Joshua and Caleb found. It's funny to say Joshua and Caleb. They went into the promised attic, and behold, it was dripping with milk and honey. Anyways, and they found this pulpit, and when I saw it last week, I was like, that is going to be good for sermon illustrations. And so I just brought a bunch today. Before we get to the illustrations, let's talk about big things and little things. That's what we're going to be talking about, big and little today, because we live in a world that believes in big and strong and smart and good-looking and believes that that's what makes for a winning life. And as I invite us to think about that, that that is what the world demands and pressures. And in the midst of that, we have today some words from Jesus about Jesus that actually seem a little different. They seem to celebrate the small and the weak and the hidden, and also even address what does winning actually mean. So let's talk about big things. So I bought my first car when I was 24 years old, and this was the first accessory that I bought for it. It is a 4-ton hydraulic jack. That's bigger than you need, by the way. My first car was not a Ford F-350 pickup. It was a beat-up 1984 Honda Accord hatchback. I don't even know that it weighed a ton. And it already had a jack. In my imagination, I got this because maybe someday I might stop and help a delivery truck driver or something who is stranded, and I could be like, excuse me, do you need a jack? So this might be an example. This is one very small example of many, many examples of when I let my ego make my decisions. And it also indicates my tendency to define my worth as being measured by things like size and strength. Do you ever do that? Do you ever do that? Do you assess your worth and the worth of others? Let me just stick this somewhere here. There. Assess your worth and the worth of others with very silly measurements. How do you measure? How do you measure? How do you measure progress and growth? How do you measure other people, like the people that you work with? The people that you live with? How do you measure the people you go to church with? How do you measure yourself? How do you measure yourself? I think if we're honest, if I'm honest, we do compare people and we value size, we value strength, we value smartness, popularity, and the list goes on. And we set up winners and losers. So it's interesting. I think we're invited to enter into an entirely different story from Jesus, that Jesus is inviting us into something different. So, first illustration is a mustard seed. So here's some potting soil. Mustard seed. I wonder what parable we're going to be studying first. I know this is not the same mustard as what Jesus was talking about. It's probably His mustard tree he was talking about has as much in common with a broccoli as this does. But it says mustard on the packet, so that's the illustration that we're getting. And this is really tiny. Do you see how tiny it is? Yeah, thank you. So I'm going to plant it right here. I'm just going to tamp it down a little bit, and I just thought I'd make the parable practical. So there we go. Do you notice that it seems as though nothing is happening? Let's just note that. It might be important. Let's read the parable. So this is Matthew chapter 13. Let's read verses 31 through 33 first. So Jesus told them another parable. The kingdom of heaven is like a mustard seed. Good, I brought one this morning. The kingdom of heaven is like a mustard seed, which a man took and planted in his field. Though it is the smallest of all seeds, yet when it grows, it is the largest of garden plants and becomes a tree, so that the birds come and perch in its branches. Love that. The birds come and perch in its branches. The kingdom of heaven is that hospitable. He told them still another parable. The kingdom of heaven is like yeast that a woman took and mixed into about 60 pounds of flour until it worked all through the dough. Okay. That might actually yield something that is visible in the context of an average length sermon. So let's try that one. I work in software, and we always say don't do live demos or take, you know, accept the risk of live demos. We're going to do a live demo. We'll see how it works. All right, so I got some water. This is apparently, reportedly, some pretty hot water. Let's check. That is hot water, which will kill the yeast. So, I have some cold water. And I'm, you know, just got to get this. This is the part that always gives me anxiety with bread making. Okay, still too hot. And then there's the whole thing of like, are my fingers really an accurate measure? I usually use like my wrist right here where it's sensitive. But I'm not going to dump water on the floor. A little bit more. I think I just used the hot water. Sure did. All right. And this is just, I haven't even added the yeast yet. Okay. We'll just do this. Okay. Sorry, most of the sermon is just going to be mixing water. Hope you're all right with that. Okay. Here we go. I'm going to call this good enough. All right, here we go. So yeast also is kind of small. And yes, I'm going to move that because I can totally see where that's going to happen. What's going to happen is we're going to get a fungal slurry knocked all over the carpet if I... So we'll move it in a little bit, trust me. And I know you're supposed to, like, always sprinkle the yeast in gradually. And usually, I mean, like, I usually use, what, one packet and making four loaves of bread. But again, 20-minute sermon. Here we go. It's bread machine yeast. I don't use a bread machine, so this stuff was going to go pretty fast, I think. All right. So I'm going to mix yeast. This is the cool thing about this, is this stuff is alive. The reason I know this works as a sermon illustration, I'm just riffing as you can tell because it's taking a little long, is because when I was in college, I lived with a bunch of strapping lads and would make like 8 loaves of bread at a time. And one time, I ran out of flour in the middle of mixing. And I was like, I'll just go to class and then pick up some more flour on the way at the grocery store and add it in. And when I came back, it was like something from a horror movie. It had climbed out of the bowl, all over the counter, all over the floor. I was like, I didn't know it could do that. All right, so I mixed the yeast up, but we need to feed the yeast. I was gonna measure this out, but for the sake of time, we're just gonna dump and pray here. This is sugar. That was probably 3 tablespoons of sugar. It sounds about right. And then we'll just add flour for effect. 3 tablespoons of flour too. We'll mix it up. Did anyone see how small those yeasts were? And I don't know how many I don't know how you can count yeasts. So they're a little fungus and if you didn't know yeast was fungus and find that disgusting, I'm so sorry to break that to you. But these are really tiny and we're gonna see if they're gonna do anything. So again, I think if I put it up here and leave it where you can see it easily, I'm gonna gesticulate and it'll knock on the floor. So we're not gonna do that. We're done stirring it. All right, we're just gonna let that incubate. Right there, and then during the boring parts of the sermon, you can just watch the yeast and hope that works for you. And then I am probably gonna be busy preaching, so if anyone notices that it's getting out of hand, I do have a contingency plan, a larger bowl that we can catch the disaster. But then again, it might not work, which is, again, maybe something worth noting. Let me just clean up here a little bit. Okay. All right, couple ideas we can notice already about both of these parables is that one, it's going to take some time, and then the second one is actually kind of cool and kind of scary, and that is the power here. There's a lot of power here in both. The power to grow into a plant or tree, the power for bread to rise. There's a lot of power there, and it's not yours or mine. Isn't that interesting? So we have these two parables, and already they've invited us to pause, to slow down, to wait, and to recognize that the power is real, but it is not us. It is not us. When we make bread, when we plant a garden or a flower or a tree, we are undertaking a beautiful and necessary practice. The practice of admiring that life and goodness are not something we control, but they come from God. So when your garden is growing, you can pat yourself on the back about some things, but ultimately the life isn't something you imbued into. It came from somewhere, someone else. So these acts of watching things grow are acts of trust, fundamental acts of trust. And then as soon as we talk about trust, we can admit that there's risk. Anytime you trust, there is risk. So we have two processes, seed, yeast, and they are beyond us, and they have begun, but we don't know when and exactly how things are going to play out, right? The water might be too hot. I maybe didn't feed it enough, or I fed it too much, or could it be old yeast? There's all sorts of things. The seed could be, it could be infertile. The ground might not be right. There might be a disease that attacks it. There's so much risk because we don't know how things are going to pan out. And because there's risk, anytime there's risk, there's this natural tendency to fear. When there's risk, there's a natural tendency to fear that it's not actually going to grow, that it's not actually going to grow big and strong and yummy. So such fear can push us, right? It can push us to do and do and do in the effort to convince ourselves that we can control this thing. Or on the other hand, it can push us to feel paralyzed and not do anything, or get in, which then is like giving up or pushing responsibility onto someone else that we perceive, or just blame someone else. All those things can happen because there's risk involved in trust when the power is not our own. I love doing sermons these days because we have this interpretive community, a group of us that gather together and all the different perspectives that come into that. One participant this week reminded us that part of the aha in these parables is that we know, and Jesus' first listeners also knew, that small bad things can have negative impact, right? Weeds and thorns, for instance, it's a parable just preceding this about that. It's like Jesus is intentionally saying that the smallest seed or yeast has great impact. It could be good or bad, although I suspect many of our minds often go to the negative on this one because that is such a common experience. We know one bad apple spoils the whole bunch, right? But Jesus is doing something different. In contrast to that fear of the bad apple, Jesus is presenting a beautiful contrast, stretching our imaginations to see that we're invited into this different, hopeful reality in which beautiful, good, God-intended things can come from very small sources that by themselves are weak. It is starting to do stuff. I don't know if you notice. It's frothing. Just letting you know that things are already happening. So do you have fears in your life currently in that way? Maybe something that's begun or you wish would begin. And if you're honest with yourself, you're just not sure it's going to make it. Will this thing germinate? Will it grow? Will it rise? Will it actually happen and become real? And are you like me, that sometimes when you consider Jesus' beautiful ways and God's deep, nourishing love, you just wonder a little bit, is this really going to play out well? I want to believe, but is this really going to play out well? Or to put that question more truthfully, we are asking, and I think we should ask, does God win? Does God win? And there's a couple ways to answer that, right? One is we can be flippant. Oh, of course, God wins. Just say it. Let's cut to the chase. God wins. We are more than conquerors. I read to the end of the book, and I know that God wins. And that's not untrue. It's maybe just not the right answer. The answer Jesus gives is not flippant. I mean, we know that the answer to the question, does God win? The answer isn't no. The answer is not no. But the answer Jesus is offering in these parables is this. For those listening at home, I just looked at the seed that is still growing. I don't know if there's anyone listening at home. I don't know if that's how it works, but you get the idea. And that answer that Jesus gives is frustrating and beautiful. So let's continue that theme and read some more of these parables. So now I'm going to start verse 44 of chapter 13 in Matthew. The kingdom of heaven is like treasure hidden in a field. When a man found it, he hid it again, and then in his joy went and sold all he had and bought that field. Pay attention to that. The kingdom of heaven is like a treasure. That was the first one. Next one. Again, the kingdom of heaven is like a merchant looking for fine pearls. When he found one of great value, he went away and sold everything he had and bought it. So, kingdom of heaven is like a treasure hidden in a field. Kingdom of heaven is like a merchant looking for pearls. We had some constructive grappling with that in interpretive community this week. So clearly, significant point from these parables is that the kingdom of heaven is like a valuable treasure. This is something valuable. It is of greater worth than all the lesser treasures that we cling to, yes? And it's worth patience and it's worth sacrifice, which is a message that is really hard for us to grapple with, but necessary for us to grapple with, especially if we have things we are holding on to. But also worth noting we were pointing out, is that in the second parable about the pearl, is that the kingdom is like, pay attention to what the kingdom is like. First, kingdom is like a treasure. The next one, kingdom is like a merchant. The kingdom of heaven is like the treasure seeker who's looking for fine pearls, the treasure seeker who is eager to make sacrifices for the beloved fine pearls. Who are the fine pearls? That is you. You are, and God is seeking you. And God is like a merchant, willing to sell everything to find you. God is willing to be broken and poured out for you, something Jesus demonstrates with his very life and death and resurrection. So the kingdom, that is, the world as God intends it to be, is of great value. It is worth marking and seeking after and waiting for and digging up, and worth so much more than many of the other things that we cling to and that we think are valuable, but are in comparison, those other things are so worth giving up for the sake of this thing. And also, God believes that you are of great value and worth, and you are worth sacrificing for. God believes that you are worth sacrifice. Both points are true, and both points are worth living. Let's continue to read, starting in verse 47. Once again, the kingdom of heaven is like a net that was let down into the lake and caught all kinds of fish. When it was full, the fishermen pulled it up on the shore. Then they sat down and collected the good fish in baskets, but threw the bad away. This is how it'll be at the end of the age. The angels will come and separate the wicked from the righteous and throw them into the blazing furnace, where there's going to be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Have you understood all these things? Jesus asked. Yes, they replied. And he said to them, therefore, every teacher of the law who has become a disciple in the kingdom of heaven is like the owner of a house who brings out of his storeroom new treasures as well as old. So there's a final sorting out that we hear in this parable of the net for sure. But it's interesting, that is in the far and unknown future, the sorting out. Meanwhile, there's this net. The kingdom of heaven is like a net that gathers all the fish, gathers all. And if we're honest with ourselves, that is very frustrating. I know the person in the seat next to me, or the person down the street from me, or the person in the next row of cubicles or desks or lockers, that those people have so many problems, and they make so many mistakes, and some of them are just plain sinners. And yet, here we are, gathered up in the same net, having a cozy time of it with one another. And Jesus seems to be saying, yeah, this is going to be sorted out, but you don't know how, and you don't know who, and it isn't up to you or me. But God's kingdom, God's intent is to gather you up together now, is to gather you together now. So those you think are winners and those you think are losers, this is the story of an annoyingly patient and merciful God. And does Jesus' audience understand? Verse 51, oh yes, they do understand. It's so good to know. Good for them. I think Jesus invites a bit of humility after their response. For those who choose to be Jesus' disciples, you're going to keep finding new as well as old treasures of understanding. And I'm reminded of a few Sundays ago where Anjanette Bender challenged us to, maybe we give up our certainty sometimes. I think Jesus is always inviting that. We're going to be finding new understanding as well as old treasures. Hang on, look at this. Still slow. And we didn't use 60 pounds of flour like the widow did, or it would have taken a lot longer. But still, cool. Let's keep considering winners and losers in Paul's words about Jesus. So looking at Romans 8, 26 through 39. Again, we're looking, we have a world that loves the big and the strong and the beautiful and the smart, and we continue on our weakness and small and what is winning anyway. So let's continue that here. So verse 26, in the same way the Spirit helps us in our weakness, we do not know what we ought to pray for, but the Spirit himself intercedes for us through wordless groans. And he who searches our hearts knows the mind of the Spirit, because the Spirit intercedes for God's people in accordance with the will of God. And we know that in all things God works for the good of those who love him, who have been called according to his purpose. For those God foreknew, he also predestined to be conformed to the image of his Son, that he might be the firstborn among many brothers and sisters. And those he predestined, he also called. Those he called, he also justified. And those he justified, he also glorified. Always worth asking, who is doing the measuring here? It is God. What then shall we say in response to these things? If God is for us, who can be against us? He who did not spare his own Son, but gave him up for us all, how will he not also, along with him, graciously give us all things? Who will bring any charge against those whom God has chosen? It is God who justifies. Who then is the one who condemns? No one. No one. Christ Jesus, who died, more than that, who is raised to life, is at the right hand of God and is also interceding for us. Who shall separate us? Who shall separate us from the love of Christ? Shall trouble or hardship or persecution or famine or nakedness or danger or sword? As it is written, for your sake, we face death all day long. We are considered as sheep to be slaughtered. No, in all these things, we are more than conquerors through him who loved us. For I am convinced that neither death nor life, neither angels nor demons, neither the present nor the future, nor any powers, neither height nor depth, nor anything else in all creation will be able to separate us from the love of God that is in Christ Jesus our Lord. I'd like to point out something that I didn't notice. There's a chiastic movement in verses 35 and 39. I wouldn't have been able to tell you exactly what that meant off the top of my head. Here we go. So Hebrew writing and poetry is sometimes chiastic. That is, it is structured in a poetic form that has an echo in it. It echoes around a central theme. So like think, I'll just use letters to represent it. It goes A, B, C, B, A, like up and down the ladder, A, B, C, B, A. Thanks to a smart poet and interpretive community whose first name was Emily but last name was not Dickinson, who pointed out this chiastic movement. And we see that in verses, particularly 35 through 39, which is kind of where I want to draw our attention. So 35, you have, what shall separate us? Separate. Okay. Two, in verse 36, we face death. Smack in the middle is verse 37, more than conquerors. Then 38, neither death. So we're back to death. Okay. We already had death once. Now it's again. And then finally, we have echo, can separate us. So there's an echoing movement in Paul's words that are drawing attention to the center while also emphasizing other bits, and it's separation, death, victory, death, separation. So A, B, C, B, A. Interesting. The point is that there's an attention being drawn to this. It draws special attention to the center, to the apex of the words. We are more than winners through the one who loved us. So that seems worth highlighting. So let's lean into that. The word traditionally translated more than conquerors might be translated differently in some of your Bibles. Maybe you have completely victorious or complete victory or something like that. The Greek word upernikomen, it's been a while since I did Greek and I wasn't good at pronouncing it then. It means like we hyper win, we super win. And doesn't that have a nice sound? We are super winning.
We are super winning.
I was once in another country where it was very common to always come up and just say, are we winning today? I love that. I love that question. Are we winning today? To which often the answer, no, I'm not winning. But anyways, but it feels nice to think about super winning, especially super conquering. Oh, that makes, it's nice to hear, especially if you've ever had moments where you feel like a loser. Like, do you ever feel like a dud of a parent? Do you feel is not as smart as your coworkers, or not as rich as your neighbors, or not as thin and fit as the people you are surrounded by at work and church, all those 30 and 40-something whippersnappers with youthful figures, not to mention John Souter? It's easy to compare and end up feeling like a loser in the process. I hope you got that. He's a fit dude. Take a look at him. Anyways, there is some of the danger, though, in how we read verse 37. If we just read, yay, we are more than conquerors, and we keep playing that comparison game that we are so prone to play, the bigger and better game of being bigger and better, then we're saying and thinking that how we define prosperity is exactly how, like if we think that how we define prosperity is exactly how God defines prosperity, then we're just using religion to prop up the games of wealth and power that everyone is already playing. And that kind of misses the point, doesn't it? I don't love dropping big words in the middle of sermons, but here's a fun one that seems worthwhile given the subject matter, and it's such fun to say. Megalomania. Megalomania. If you have not heard the word, you might get it confused with some other words. So I'll do a little process of elimination. You might think it sounds like a prehistoric shark. No, that's megalodon. Okay. If you have an unusually intense fear of skyscrapers or aircraft carriers or blue whales, you may have megalophobia, but it's not that. This is something else. That's the fear of large things. That'd be worth helping you grapple with, though. But it's not the subject of this sermon. You may have heard of megalomane. That's a type of very large Chinese noodles. Not the word I'm referring to. Megaloquacious. That's overly talkative, using big words like I am this morning. I don't know anyone with that problem. Maybe you've encountered a megalope. That's a very sweet giant melon. I have made up half the words just this week that I've just given you. So megalomania is a condition that causes people to think that they have great power or importance. Megalomania is an obsession with power and wealth and fame and a passion for grand schemes. And if you're like me, when you think of megalomania, your mind leaps to identify certain people you are sure are megalomaniacs, like take Caligula. Caligula, the brief Roman emperor, very brief because he was, a very brief Roman emperor who came along a few years after Jesus' death. He believed he was a god, which is a telltale sign of megalomania, if you're looking. He held contempt for the Roman Senate and other traditional institutions that got in his way. He launched very extravagant and self-glorifying projects, such as when he wanted to install a statue of himself as Zeus in the temple in Jerusalem, right? So Herod talked him out of that one. He didn't actually do it. And we point our fingers at such folks, and we say, now that is a megalomaniac. And then we don't always take the time to note that the megalomania is as much caused by the people around the megalomaniac. Julius and Augustus Caesar had already built up this role of Roman emperor as a godlike deity already. And Roman society was built around this cult of the emperor. And we put pressures on heroes and scapegoats and leaders and make it all about them as though they can solve our problems. And there were military and financial realities at the time that supported and required that deification and so on. And so, when in verse 37, Paul writes that we are more than conquerors, he certainly means that in God's love and strength, The things that seem most intimidating, even death itself, need not defeat us. Certainly, that is the message. If God is for us, who can be against us? And nothing can separate us from the love of God. Nothing. But might the phrase, more than conquerors, again, keep in mind, this is during Roman emperor worship, might the word more than conquerors also emphasize the very different ways of winning, the different way of winning that Jesus is offering and inviting here? We win, but we win differently, not by conquering others, but we win by not even playing the game. We win by refusing to play the game, the megalomania game, the conquest game. Not being megalomaniacs ourselves and not requiring other people to be megalomaniacs to give us hope. So there's this Roman emperor level of megalomania, and then there are also little megalomanias. Say that a few times. Little megalomanias that many of us experience at different points in our own lives, our own delusions of grandeur, in which we imagine, and here the flip side here too, we imagine that we alone are responsible for the success or failure of our world. So it could be a megalomania of grandeur, it can also be the megalomania of also believing that all failures are our problem as well. And that kind of megalomania is a combination both of the fear we've already mentioned and a misguided faith, a lack of trust in the right thing. Fear that we're ultimately going to be losers, that we're not big enough, that we're not strong enough, that we're not good-looking enough, we're not smart enough, and so on. Fear that the seed might never grow, that the batch of dough might never rise. It's bubbling. It's at the top now. Good thing I had the tray. And the misguided faith when we believe that we, or our heroes and leaders, are ultimately able to bring us to a hopeful end. The invitation to hope in Jesus is the invitation to measure differently, not with megalomania, but to look at how Jesus treats weakness, utilizes weakness and the small. Weak is what we are. Weak is what we are, but the Spirit helps us in our weakness. We do not know what we ought to pray for, but the Spirit intercedes for us on our behalf. The ultimate rule by which we are measured is the inseparable love of God. The treasure seeker considers you of unending worth and value, considers the person next to you of unending worth and value. The measure is the immeasurable love of God.